This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. government has seized control of dozens of Iranian websites it accuses of spreading disinformation. We get details from AP correspondent Jennifer King.
The move by American authorities appears to be a far-reaching crackdown on Iranian media. An official who spoke on condition of anonymity said the U.S. had seized roughly three dozen websites, visits to the address of a handful of sites, including Iran State Television's English language arm, produced a federal notice that said the websites were seized as part of law enforcement action. Also taken down the domain name for the news website Palestine Today and a satellite news channel for Yemen's Houthi rebel group. The takedown comes just days after the election victory of Iran's hardline judiciary chief, Ibrahim Raisi, known for his hostility to the West. Jennifer King, Washington.
The UN's top envoy for Afghanistan urges the international community to do everything possible to push the Taliban and the government from the battlefield back to the negotiating table, warning that inertia and the lack of action might lead to more years of bloodshed and conflict. Deborah Lyons told the UN Security Council that she cannot overstate her concern at the current situation, saying every major trend, politics, security, the peace process, the economy, humanitarian emergency, and tackling COVID-19 is either negative or stagnant. Canada and China have sparred over human rights at the UN-backed Human Rights Council. Canada and 40 other countries urged China to allow immediate, meaningful, and unfettered access so independent observers can visit the Western Xinjiang region. Also Tuesday, a Chinese envoy called on Canadian authorities to stop violations of human rights at home. The mutual finger pointing, which preceded admissions from Canada's envoy about shortcomings in a country's rights record, came in a debate. This is VOA News. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports that the U.S. House will then have its own investigation into the deadly incursion at the U.S. Capitol that took place in January.
At a private leadership meeting, an insider tells the Associated Press, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that she's creating a new committee that will investigate the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th of this year. The announcement comes after last month's test vote in the Senate, in which Republican lawmakers blocked the proposal from going forward.
That's AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says that he will support long-debated changes to the military justice system that would remove decisions on prosecuting sexual assault cases from military commanders. In a statement obtained by the Associated Press, Austin says he supports taking those sexual assault and related crimes away from the chain of command and letting independent military lawyers handle them. The Pentagon has long resisted such a change, but Austin and other senior leaders are slowly acknowledging that the military has failed to make progress against sexual assault, and some changes are in fact needed. Hong Kong Court of Appeals upheld on Tuesday a court decision to deny by a trial by a jury to the first person charged under a new national security law, a landmark decision that marks a departure from the global financial hub's common law tradition. Last month, the court, first in instance in the High Court, ruled that Tung Ying Kit would face a trial without jury, citing a perceived risk of the personal safety of jurors and their family members. His lawyer appealed. Police say that Tong carried a sign reading "Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times," and drove his motorbike into officers during a protest on July 1st, knocking several down on a narrow street before falling over and getting arrested. Recapping one of our top stories, the UN's top envoy for Afghanistan is urging the international community to do everything possible to push the Taliban and the government from the battlefield back to the negotiating table, warning that inertia and the lack of action might lead to more years of bloodshed and conflict. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some Democratic Republic of Congo rebels surrender their weapons.
Those who accept to surrender, they are accepted by the army peacefully, and they can give back their weapon. And that's what the new military governor of North Kivu said in Masisi.
Burundi says the European Union has lifted sanctions on the Central African country. We'll get reaction. What's behind the spate of armed robberies in Zimbabwe? Cameroon's first female deputy chiefs battle gender inequalities. And there's a need for Africa to produce its own vaccines for COVID and other illnesses.
The need was there anyway, but COVID-19 has actually emphasized the need for Africa to venture into vaccine manufacture and become a global player in vaccine manufacture.
And the plight of widows in Kenya on this International Day of Widows. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. More than 140 rebel fighters in the Democratic Republic of Congo surrendered themselves and their weapons to authorities. The move on Monday comes more than a month after the DRC government imposed a state of siege on Kivu and Ituri provinces in an effort to stem the surge in militant violence. Journalist Jaffa El Katanti was at the surrender ceremony in the city of Kichanga, and he spoke with viewers Kate Pound Dawson about what led to the surrender.
Fighters came from different militias in Masisi territory and Walikale. Some of them are from FDLR, some Mai Mai's group and Nyantura groups.
So what led to their surrender?
It's because of the pressure of operations. As you know, since the state of siege in North Kivu and Ituri provinces, army are executing many operations against the rebel groups. And during the operation, they also call for all of them to surrender. Those who accept to surrender, they are accepted by the army peacefully, and they can give back their weapon. And that's what the new governor, the military governor of North Kivu, said in Masisi when talking to people. He said the time of negotiation has been expired. Now we are imposing peace to all Congolese people. So if a militiaman is a Congolese, he has to surrender. Otherwise, he will receive the pressure of the Congolese army power.
Now, in addition to the governor's comments, how else is the government responding? Are they offering to help surrendered fighters return home or anything like that?
First, the governor said it's a good news to see Congolese who accept to leave weapon and to take the process of peace. And because of that, they will make a biggest process for surrenders. Some of them are very young, who are not even 18 years old. Those will be taken care of by UNICEF and NGOs, because they are children. And those who are not children, it will be on their choice. Someone who will need to become a soldier, all of them will be sent to a training center of FRDC so that they will become member of the National Army.
That was journalist Jaffa El Katanti speaking with viewers Kate Pound Dawson from the city of Kichanga in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Burundi said this week that the European Union has suspended sanctions it imposed on the Central African country. The government said this happened after meeting with EU ambassadors to Burundi. The sanctions, which suspended financial cooperation between Burundi and the EU, were imposed in 2016 after then-President Pierre Nkurunziza decided to seek a third term, which led to protests. But some Burundians say the election of President Evariste Ndayishimiye has brought about a new chapter of openness. Louis March is the Central Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. He says the European Union should not have lifted sanctions because there's evidence of continuing human rights violations in Burundi.
This is a decision taken by the European Union that is contrary to the principles of the European Union. The European Union purports itself to be an institution and a conglomerate of states that puts human rights first. And the fact is that while there's been some piecemeal gestures on the part of the government of Burundi with regards to releasing some political prisoners, systematic change has not happened in Burundi. I think it's important to remember that Burundi, before 2015, was seen as a beacon for the region for freedom of expression, for freedom of association, and for freedom of people to vote the way they wanted to. It was a place where there were opposition politicians, where journalists could criticize government policy. That is not the case anymore in Burundi. This is a closed country, and it's becoming increasingly more so. And it's a country where there still continues to be absolutely no accountability. And the thousands of people who have been killed since the violence in 2015, many of them killed by state actors, including the youth militia tied to the ruling party. So this is, in some ways, this could be viewed as a cynical move by the European Union. They clearly want to turn the page and restart with Burundi, but this does not reflect the real situation in Burundi with regards to human rights abuse.
But Luis, I think the Burundian government or supporters of the Burundian government would say that since the elections and the election of President Evariste Ndayishimiye has moved forward to improve its image and relations with other countries. What do you say to that?
Well, there you go. That's exactly it. The country has moved forward to improve its image, but that image polishing has not been met with realities on the ground. The fact is that the judiciary is closed. The judiciary is controlled by the president. You have human rights defenders and journalists that are locked up and that are held for years in prison. And then when the government decides it wants to, quote unquote, improve its image, it releases them. It gives them a pardon. These are people who have never committed a crime. They never should have been locked up in the first place. And while it is a very good thing that they're out of prison, they've been released, that doesn't mean that we should accept these gestures from the government of releasing these people as steps moving forward. What it means is that the government is actually further entrenching human rights abuses by perpetuating a system that continues to punish people for criticizing. So the steps forward by the Burundian government have been piecemeal in gestures, and they are done explicitly to improve the image of the country, not to actually address the human rights abuses that are ongoing, in particular since 2015.
Some would say this is not encouraging if, let's say, your group and critics of the government keep insisting that these sanctions should not be lifted. Then what happens to if the government wants to bring about development for the people of Burundi and is willing to be open?
So, you know, the Human Rights Watch, we work in over 90 countries, and our job is explicitly to document human rights abuses and expose them and push for change. And our job is not to congratulate the government of Burundi for massive steps backwards with regards to its human rights policy. The fact is, the government is absolutely entitled to opening its country up to development. The government absolutely should want to have financial ties with groups like the European Union. These ties and this development is not mutually exclusive with a broad respect for human rights.
Luis, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much. Take care.
That was Luis March, the Central Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. Zimbabwe is experiencing a spate of armed robberies as the country's economic meltdown continues. This despite projections of economic growth from institutions such as the World Bank. From Bulawayo, Ade Gondo has this report.
Last week, Police Commissioner General Godwin Matanga instructed provincial commanders to deploy special units to deal with increasing number of armed robberies occurring across the country. He has directed the police to escalate stop and search patrols and roadblocks. It's part of an effort to reduce the proliferation of illegally owned guns, which the police say are behind the recent spike in armed robberies nationwide. The Minister of Home Affairs says authorities are working to stop the crimes but face many challenges, including the smuggling of firearms by criminal syndicates through the country's porous borders, resource constraints, and licensed firearms that have not been secured in a safe place and are thus easy to steal. Bulawayo province is one of the hotspots for armed robberies with fatalities in the past few months. Socioeconomic analysts say, aside from the COVID-19 induced challenges, are robberies of hard cash from homes and businesses that have little faith in the banking institutions to keep their money safe. They also say cross-border criminals from neighboring South Africa are active in transit heists and have lately been targeting security companies around the region. Senior Assistant Commissioner Patton Bangwa for Bulawayo Province could not give statistics on the number of robberies and played down the incidence of smuggled firearms.
You see, when we get reports, we're simply told, here's something that looks like a firearm. It's not very said here and there. It might be a firearm, it might not be a firearm. So for one to say these are smuggled guns, it's neither here nor there. You can only give a conclusive sort of assessment if you have really a firearm that would have recovered.
The Minister of Home Affairs acknowledged in Parliament that the police are under-equipped. The Minister of Finance announced recently that government has purchased an additional 100 vehicles and motorcycles to assist the police. But observers say there's likely not enough vehicles for all of the police stations around the country, especially in remote towns. Some observers charge that members of the armed forces may be involved in the armed robberies. For instance, a recent report by the Southern Africa Resource Watch accuses soldiers and police officers of involvement in illegal gold smuggling activities. Critics say members of the security forces have been apprehended in armed robbery cases, and security issued weapons such as AK-47 rifles have been used in armed robberies. Police Chief Mbangwa had this reaction to the allegations.
For one to really say it was an AK, for us it's a bit difficult because you need to come for us to comment conclusively to say indeed there was an AK.
Farai Maguwu of Zimbabwe's Center of Natural Resource Governance says that it is highly unlikely that ordinary people would have access to guns because of the country's tough gun laws. He says those who do include the security sector, the military, the Central Intelligence Organization, the police, private security companies, and a few business people.
When you look at the rise in the state of robberies, you also look at the state of the economy, especially what the private security guards are earning, what the police, the military are earning. They're earning peanuts, these people, whilst also entrusting them with the weapons. It sets the country on a very dangerous path for criminality and the like. They're setting them up or inciting them to commit armed robberies.
Magu and others say that government could likely solve the problem in part by providing higher pay to members of the security sector so as to discourage them from stealing. If authorities do not grant pay increases, critics say they fear the attacks in Zimbabwe may continue to soar. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 23rd. Countries such as South Africa and Rwanda are the most likely targets for hubs where vaccines might be produced in Africa, according to the World Health Organization. The WHO Africa Regional Advisor on Vaccine Regulation Quality and Safety, Deki Akamori, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the need for vaccines for both COVID-19 and other illnesses to be produced in Africa.
The huge thing that's going on is to try and support South Africa, a company in South Africa, to at least manufacture the Janssen & Janssen vaccine. And then, of course, extending to receiving parts of the product to get from the U.S., a U.S. facility, and to complete the process in South Africa and see if we can manufacture, you know, or make more of these COVID-19 vaccines. But you see, this is only to help address the immediate gap, but it's also not going to fulfill the needs of the continent. I mean, you know the population of Africa. There's no way one facility in South Africa, even if we had 2-3 facilities, can't make sufficient vaccine. We still absolutely need countries to donate doses for use on the continent. Now, the major discussion now is ongoing to really come up with a good plan which covers every aspect of vaccine manufacture, to building around these R&D hubs.
And are there certain countries that are looking more likely than others at this point?
Yeah, there are countries that are looking more likely. I mean, obviously, from the WHO point of view, the regulatory capacity is important. So we certainly are looking at countries with regulatory systems that are sufficiently, you know, robust that, or that are on the rise that can provide oversight. Also based on the political will, the willingness to take the bold step forward. So there are countries like Rwanda, there are countries like South Africa. Ghana has a very, one of the strongest regulatory authorities on the continent. Obviously, that's something you have to look out for. Senegal has a history of vaccine manufacture, but the regulatory system may not be that strong.
Obviously, in this context, people would think of COVID-19 vaccines, but are we talking about vaccines that can address other illnesses?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to think beyond COVID-19 vaccines. COVID-19 vaccines have actually really, really identified the need. The need was there anyway, but COVID-19 has actually emphasized the need for Africa to venture into vaccine manufacture and become a global player in vaccine manufacture.
I'll go back to COVID-19. There has been a lot of vaccine hesitancy, at least where I live, in Senegal and parts of West Africa. Do you think that if the vaccine was manufactured locally, that would help decrease hesitancy toward the vaccine?
It could, in fact. That is, in fact, a very, very important point you make. Because when you make a product, you make it because you want to use it. It could be a means of also overcoming the vaccine hesitancy and convincing populations that this is a good thing. Vaccines save lives.
That was Deki Akamori, WHO Africa Regional Advisor on Vaccine Regulation Quality and Safety. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Brazzaville. In northern Cameroon, councils of traditional rulers were customarily all men, but in the last 2 years have opened to women. These pioneer female deputy chiefs are battling early marriage in a region where the majority of girls are married before age 18. Moki Edwin Kizika narrates this report by Anne Unzuanku in Mokolo, Cameroon.
2 years ago, Fadimatu Adamu's parents arranged her marriage as a 16-year-old to a man more than twice her age. Her husband often beat her, says Adamu, until she was rescued by the region's first female chiefs. She says she was suffering there and didn't even have enough to eat. It was Aja Kaigama, says Adamu, who gave money to her older sister Aisatu, who came to take her back home. Cameroon's Council of Traditional Rulers, or chiefs, are customarily men. But in the last 2 years, 11 women like Aja Kaigama Saidu have been appointed as deputy chiefs. While they are still under the direction of a higher-ranking male chief, Saidu says the new role means they can do more to help women. Their work with women is to explain to them how they can go through the deputy chiefs to express their needs at the level of the chiefdom, she says, and to denounce violence against women. Saidu says women have problems that they cannot express to men. It is through the women chiefs, she says, that they easily express their needs. The UN's Children's Fund says while more than a third of Cameroonian girls are married before the age of 18 and miss out on school, the rate jumps to 60% in the country's north. Student Aisatu Chanigi got pregnant when she was 15 years old. Her parents wanted to pull her out of school and marry her off, but the women chiefs convinced them otherwise. Chanigi says the women chiefs came to talk with her parents and convinced them that even if she has a child, if the parents do not abandon their daughter, she has the right, she has every chance in the world to succeed. It took 4 years of lobbying by the Association of Women and Girls of the Adamawa region, AFADA, to get the chiefdoms to agree to open to women. AFADA President Francois Baba says that since 2019, the female chiefs have helped hundreds of women and girls in cases of gender-based violence and to access health care and education.
dans un village où nous avons désormais nos femmes notables.
She says in the villages where they now have women chiefs, the feedback they have received from schools is that the enrollment rate of young girls has increased by 40% for this school year. A father says they will continue to push for more women chiefs to reduce Cameroon's gender inequalities. For Anne Zwanke in Mokolo, Cameroon, Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
Today, June 23rd, is International Widows Day, set aside in 2011 by the United Nations to draw attention to the voices of widows. According to the United Nations, there are at least 258 million widows around the world, with nearly 1 in 10 living in extreme poverty. The UN says many widows across the world have struggled for basic needs, their human rights and dignity. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, 15% of Kenyan population are widows, with rural widows being disadvantaged and their rights violated the most by harmful cultural practices.
In the past few years, the Kenyan government has marked International Widows Day with efforts to raise awareness on the plight of widows. With more than 8 million widows in Kenya, most of them are denied inheritance rights, evicted from their homes, forced into unwanted marriages, and others are taken through traumatizing widowhood rituals. Diana Ogutu lost her husband in 2018 after being married for 14 years, and due to harsh custom practices, Diana has never gone back to her home.
I lost my husband after a short illness, and life after that has not been easy. The customs and the traditions have not been friendly to me. So from the villagers, I never received kind treatments. It has been harsh. Like as we speak, my house is like a hall. And even as we speak, this is now my second year, I've never stepped back home because I'm just scared. First of all, I was threatened by somebody that they will inherit me by force.
Widows are always stigmatized for life, and in most cases, many of these abuses go unnoticed. Roselyn Orua has been a widow for 13 years, having lost her husband during the 2008 post-election violence in Kenya. She came up with a foundation that has brought together more than 8,000 widows.
Rona Foundation was started as an idea of me wanting a space to heal. 13 years as a childless widow, I have experienced different stages of discrimination, disinheritance, and harmful traditional practices meted on women when they lose their husbands.
Roslyn says most widows in Kenya have been accused of killing their husbands by the in-laws, and this leads to most of them losing their property.
From name calling to accusations of why did you kill him, from discrimination to even how you were living with your husband as you were married. You know, in my community, widows are known as the wife of the grave. So even this naming, how you are associating a living woman with the grave, is also another level of mental torture.
The Marriage Act in Kenya calls for registering all marriages and granting women a legal basis for land ownership claims as succession laws bars her husband's relatives from assuming her inheritance. Rose, however, says the legal succession in Kenya is very tedious.
Looking for legal documentation from succession to going even to court on matters of disinheritance is so costly and full of bureaucracy. So a lot of widows just give up. And then all these forms are in English. And so you need also a level of education to be able to process, you know, seek for your rights under the law. And so widows just get disinherited, even by scrupulous lawyers. And so the system is so difficult for a widow.
With this year's theme for Widows Day being Invisible Women, Invisible Problems, this day works to encourage action in achieving full rights for widows and develop policies to address problems faced by widows. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you to have a very good day.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, the reparations debate. Should descendants of slaves be compensated for the free labor their ancestors were forced to render during slavery? We talk with two analysts who spar over the renewed push for reparations in America and discuss some contemporary experiments taking place in states and cities across the country. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.